Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Since his novel The Air Affair was released in 2002, Jasper Ford has been entertaining fans with novels that he describes as incorporating a narrative dare. Jasper Ford's novel Early Riser will be released in paperback in the coming weeks, and he explained to me that that novel's narrative dare is that it's set in a world where humans have always hibernated. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's the rest of our conversation. Hibernating, overwintering, parting out, dreams, I'm not quite sure where to begin, and I'm sure when you were writing this, you probably had an elevator speech where if somebody would say, what are you working on next? What's your next book about? You could probably tell them. Would you mind giving that to us just to start us off?
Yeah. How I've always written my books is by something that I call the narrative dare. So the first book that I got published was something called The Air Affair, and it was the narrative dare in that is that Jane Eyre is kidnapped out of Jane Eyre, and somebody has to get her back. So, you know, expand on that, 110,000 words. So this one, the narrative dare, which is also the elevator pitch, is write a thriller set in a world in which humans have always hibernated. And that's actually, that is a lot of unpacking to do, because the interesting word, I think, in that sentence is not, you know, humans or hibernate or thriller, it's always. We've always done it. So to us, it's very, very normal. And because we've evolved with this notion of hibernation, then we've evolved, obviously, slightly differently. And it's those differences that I think is where you create the really good, fun drama in fantasy. Because we're changing a very small thing, and then we're looking at the rippling out of the effects of it. And that's really what I'm doing in this book. I've got my character, Charlie Worthing, new to the winter, trying to figure out just how the winter works if you're awake rather than asleep.
You know, that word always, it really, that is the key word. Because when I first started reading it, you know, well, two things. I was curious about the dates, because at first I was wondering if it was futuristic, a warning about global warming. But then, you know, you talked about 1975. And, you know, then there was also the reference to Shakespeare writing in Falstaff as a character, someone unseasonably portly for surviving winters. And so...
This is a really interesting fact. I think it's set around 2003. That seems to be around the sort of time it seems to be set. But when you mention that about Shakespeare, and I think that when one writes fantasy novels, they are obviously slightly odd, they're slightly off-kilter, and a lot is very strange in them. But what I like to do is I like to try and put in what I call standard candles, right? There are these things that remain the same, that even if humans could run their history in a million different ways, but somehow there'd always be Shakespeare and Fawlty Towers, say. You know, they will always be there. You know, Winnie the Pooh, Shakespeare, and Monty Python, they'd always be there. And the way in which we react to them is a good way of saying, this is how the world is. This is a recognizable world. It's not a world in which you don't understand. So I think it's very important to put all that stuff in, all that pop culture references. It can be very funny. I like playing with them. But also it's a question of saying, no, this is a recognizable world. Don't worry. It's only a little bit odd.
You know, in this world, winter, you know, since we have always hibernated, winter takes its toll on the population because we have these long winters. And I think I was looking at the guide earlier, and the month was defined as 59 days. And now I'm not even quite sure. But keeping the population numbers high was a high priority. And this becomes evident when we're introduced to the quote-unquote sisters who are named after female reproductive organs. At this point, It reminded me of Brave New World meets The Handmaid's Tale. Did you have any influencers when it came to this idea? Was this political at all?
I almost certainly. One goes back to these kind of, you know, sort of seminal works that look at things like this. But I think what happened was that I started looking at the world and I thought hibernating is with great risk. And that's an interesting concept in itself, because the parents that you have may not be your biological parents because they've died. The notion that you could, you know, grow up as a family unit is kind of alien to the people in this world. And for that reason, there is kind of socialized childcare in a curious kind of way. And how would that function? And also with high mortality, everybody is expected to have as many children as possible. And of course, then that brings into this notion of having a whole group of nuns whose credo is, you know, having lots of children so you don't have to. And they see that as the guiding principle of their order. I think they're called the Sisters of the Perpetual Gestation. And this is, again, a very big thing. And it also alludes to, I wasn't wanting making a huge deal of it, but it kind of alludes to the vital importance of the female and the generally kind of slightly less important male within the book. And certainly there's a couple of characters who seem to be simply sires and nothing else. So there's all these kind of subtle things. So although I don't make a huge deal of them in the book, they are there. And in a sort of fantasy pretend world, I think there are a lot of different small details that make up a very, very sort of vibrant picture. So I don't make a huge deal of them, but I think it's important that I allude to these kind of notions. And Charlie, my protagonist, has grown up as someone remaindered in the orphanage where Charlie was brought up. And keeps on being passed on. You know, no one wants Charlie because Charlie has a bit of a wonky-looking face. And I think that, then, is important, and that, you know, alludes to Charlie's character. And again, it's just these small details, I think, that make up a much more sort of vibrant picture.
So, you know, without giving away too many spoilers, what can you tell us about this world? What is wintering? How do people overwinter or hibernate? Or I've probably already given away too much.
No, that's fine. I think it's 4 months during a very, very bitter winter when the temperatures are absolutely glacial. You know, if you step outside, it's, you know, there's a possibility you just won't last 10 minutes. I mean, it's that bad. The story really begins around a time in late August, which is called Fat Thursday, which is when everyone starts to bulk up. Because the notion of body shape is, of course, I turn completely on its head. Because if you're kind of, you know, I'm pretty skinny, really. But if somebody were to see me 2 days before hibernation, they would know that I would not survive the winter. It would be extremely unhealthy for me to have a low body mass. So one can play with these sort of notions. So everybody has to bulk up for the winter. And if they don't sufficiently bulk up, then they may not survive. The winter consuls are the people who look after, part of the skeleton crew that look after the sleeping masses. Part of the people who are awake have to look after things like infrastructure support so that the world can get started again. But there's also the winter consuls, like Charlie, who have to look after the sleeping people to make sure that everything is all right, to make sure that they can maximize the survivability of the sleeping masses. And it's really about what it's like in a space that you've never been before. Charlie has hibernated every year for the last 23 years, and to Charlie, like most people, the winter does not exist. You go to sleep and you wake up and nothing has happened. It's like 4 hours is gone out of your life. And I kind of like the idea that actually a lot goes on in that 4 months. And these people who, the winter consuls, nobody thinks very much of them because they remind you of the night and the winter and sort of, you know, death and all those sort of things. So no one's really interested in what the winter consuls do, and they do a huge amount, but Charlie only really finds out when they have to stay awake. So it's kind of like discovery. I think if anyone's listening who's worked night shift for any period of time, or if you've worked night shift, it's kind of like that. I've done night work when I worked in the film industry. And there's this kind of graveyard sort of shift mentality about it, around about, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning. And it's like different rules apply. You know, everything's slightly off kilter. And the people who are attracted to night work are slightly different people. They're not the same as the people who like to work, you know, during the day. So all these elements come into it, I think, which add kind of interest to it.
We have never met. I've seen your photo on your jacket and online, but we've never met. But I'm glad that you You told me you're skinny, so I can ask you, what is your relationship with food?
What, the comfort? You mean the comfort food?
Well, I was just reading of, you know, everything everybody had to eat to winter up, and it was making me a little bit sick to think about all that food.
Well, if it's a survival, well,
I know.
I think it's very interesting, you know, about, you know, body mass and shape and all that kind of stuff, and it's very much an evolutionary survival mechanism that now seems to have become a way that you can shame people on social media, which is not what it was intended. You know, we bulk up because we don't know when the next meal's come from, and for a million years in our evolution, that was a very good way to survive a hostile environment. So, you know, it sort of changed, it's on its head a bit. But I kind of like the idea. I mean, I would not like to spend my winter eating comfort food, but I kind of like the notion of what comfort food means to people, and the notion that the winter is cold, it's dark, it's miserable, it's depressing, it's unpleasant, and one of the ways that you can ameliorate the difficulty is just to eat a lot of comfort food. Rice pudding, Tonics tea cakes, chocolate, you know, Twinkies, anything like that, which are notoriously really not very good for you if that's all you eat. Fine in moderation. And it was just kind of that way of saying you need a lot of energy, you have to have a lot of sugar going through you to try and keep warm in the winter, but it's also a sense of trying to keep sane, you know, to try and stay happy in this time, which is actually something that you shouldn't be doing, staying awake during the winter.
You know, in addition to the book, I'm holding the handbook of winterology in my hand. And so I'm curious. Go ahead, what?
Yeah, no, I was battling to get that on the website yesterday on the north.
Oh, really?
So I'm very glad you got a copy. Yeah.
How long have you been thinking about this world, and how long have you been working on this project?
Well, I mean, that's actually a really good question, because this is up until I was doing a book a year up until Early Riser. I did, I think, 13 books in 13 years. And for me, writing a book a year was not a problem. It would take me 7 months, and I'd write 100,000 words, and every August, July, August, we'd have a book out. Now, for some reason, and I'm not exactly sure how, Early Riser took me nearly 3-4 years to write. And it wasn't a question of just sort of not being able to write, physically. I was writing and writing and writing, and the story wasn't working. And I still don't know what the problem was. And I found myself in the early, you know, the first 2 years, it was just writing a very, very complicated world, which, of course, is not really readable, to be honest, because you want people in it, and you want jeopardy, you want love, anger, hate, resentment, sacrifice, you want all these sorts of things, but it wasn't working. So it took a long time to work on, and in that period, I think I got a lot of detail were coming in. And what you're reading in the book, the original draft, this is 110,000 words, I think, this the book. The first draft was nearly 180,000.
Wow.
So I chucked out 70,000 words of very strange, you know, little peripheral tangential adventures, which really weren't very good at all. But I kept everything that I thought was good and sound and exciting. So in that way, I think that 3 or 4 years might have helped a little bit. But I don't know what happened. I just couldn't write for some reason. I'll figure it out.
Well, I had seen some chatter from fans about how long they had to wait since the last book. And one reviewer even said that, you know, we could set our watch by you. Is there a pressure to perform to get back to that one book a year, or has this relieved that pressure a little bit?
I don't really know. I mean, I must say, I think the pressure, I didn't really feel pressure from readers. I think readers were always very, very generous. I mean, it was really rather nice, actually, because I was having problems, you know, writing this book, and, you know, I'd get emails from people saying, you know, well, where's the sequel to Shades of Grey, which is, I get that a lot, you know, when is this going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And then after about 3 years, I started getting emails from people saying, are you okay? Which I thought was so touching. I mean, it really was, you know. Jasper, you haven't had a book out for 3.5 years, and usually you have a book a year. You know, are you okay? You know, is there anything we can help with? And that was just so nice. And it goes a lot to what readers are about and how reading, you know, makes people empathize, you know, and what an engine that reading is, the engine for empathy, I believe. And that was really nice. But I didn't feel pressure. I felt more that I wanted to get it right. You know, that was the big annoying thing for me, is I could have just written 100,000 words and it would have just been okay. But I don't want my books to be okay. I want them to be the best possible read I can give to myself and my readers. You know, I think very strongly there's like the pact, you know, readers give me their hard-earned cash and in return I have to entertain the best possible way I can. So I think there was a pressure on myself, you know, not to fail in that respect.
Earlier, you used the term fantasy novel. Do readers and reviewers define your genre in that way? Or do you agree that your books are fantasy novels, or what would you call them?
I don't know. I mean, I may be speculative fiction, but that sounds a bit, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a big fan of genre. I think it's a construct by perhaps publicity marketeering. I'm not sure. So I was reading True Grit the other day, Charles Portis, and I think that would be defined as a Western by genre, but it's not a Western. It's coming of age, it's revenge, it's historical, almost philosophical. I think it's a fantastic novel, but to put it under Western might mean that it's actually in with some other books that were not of the same caliber, and I think that would be a huge shame. So I think genre is slightly worrying. I'd just like to say sort of absurdist fiction or speculative fiction, but fantasy is kind of what people understand, as long as they don't think it's goblins and spells, which isn't in the book at all.
I remember when your first book, The Air Affair, it was the first book in the Thursday Next series. It was released in, was it 2002?
Yeah, 02 in the States.
But before you worked in literature, you had the career in film that you mentioned. Do you have any regrets of switching from one to the other?
No. I did for a bit. I mean, I missed the people. I mean, the great thing about working in the film industry, it's tremendously exciting. There's a lot of very funny, clever people who work in the film industry. And that always makes for, you know, very good socializing when you go on location. You know, it really is a blast. It is great fun, hugely enjoyable. And I missed the camaraderie, I must say. But I was only ever an assistant. I started off being a cameraman. But even as a cameraman, I would be, you know, a hired hand like anyone else. And being in the camera department, as a cameraman, it's kind of creative. But being an author, I'm really doing, I think, what I was kind of meant to do, which was just make up really silly ideas and then play with them, have fun, and eventually, you know, get them out there into the reading public. So I miss the excitement of it because, a good day for me is sitting for 8 hours in front of a screen and having, like, two or three really good ideas. That's an exciting day for me. And that's very different to working in the film business. But I wouldn't swap it for anything. No, being an author, it's a great life. Yeah, it really is. It really is great fun.
You know, there was one part. It was a piece of advice given to Charlie when he was, it was really early in the book. But he said, stay close, do what I say, and make as many mistakes as you want. Just never the same one twice. Did anybody ever say that to you?
Yes, they did. Yeah. I started off, like many people, in the film industry as a runner, or I think they're called gophers in the States. And I made coffee and photocopied. Now, that's what I did. I worked as a production office runner, aged 20, in Shepperton Studios, on a film called The Pirates of Penzance, the musical. And my first celebrity coffee was Angela Lansbury.
Oh, wow.
That's great, isn't it? You know, Miss Lansbury, she came up into the office to talk about something, and it was, Jasper, would you get Miss Lansbury a coffee? Yeah, and I was like, oh, yes, how do you take it? And she was delightful, of course, as you might imagine. So I kind of started off in the film industry, and the thing about the film biz is, of course, that everybody there knows that yesterday's runner is tomorrow's producer. So everyone is actually quite nice to you, and they also know that you've got to kind of learn the ropes as well. And I do remember a prop man. His name was Barry Wilkinson. I can still remember his name now. And he said, "Oh, you knew then, Jasper." And I went, "Yeah." And he said, "Well," and he gave me that piece of advice. He said, "Make as many mistakes as you want, but don't make the same one twice." And there were all sorts of little nuggets like that that I picked up starting off in the film business, and it was good actually, and I kept that one, what was another one? Someone said to me, focus puller Mike said to me, "Time spent on reconnaissance is never wasted."
I'm going to start hanging out with you. I like everything that you're saying.
Yeah, time spent on reconnaissance is never wasted. It's a good one, isn't it? I mean, that comes from the military, obviously. But it's absolutely true. Time spent on reconnaissance is never wasted. You know, don't leap in and make a decision. Just kind of hang around and stay on the edges for a while. Get the measure of what's going on and then, you know, do something or say something. Just take a measured approach. You know, it's not a good idea to just leap in half-cocked. So that was another good one. Yeah, all sorts of little ones that come from here and there and everywhere.
That was Jasper Ford, author of the book Early Riser, which was published by Penguin. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.